We're going to try over here for talking today. The Bible and I have a difficult relationship. I was not raised to think of the Bible as a particularly holy book. I was raised to think of the Bible as an ancient book, to be respected in the same way that I respect the Quran, the Torah or Tanakh, the Egyptian Book of the Dead, and collections of, forgive me, Greek mythology. The Bible is interesting, it's old, there are some good stories in there, but it never really occurred to me to use it as a singular moral compass. I grew up in Waco, Texas, down the road, where it was clear from a very early age that my view of the Bible was not the typical view in town. Maybe some of you have experienced that. When I was 13 or 14, I went ahead and just read the Bible, although I skipped a lot of the begats and some of the weird laws. I mostly wanted the stories, because it turns out that's what we want. We want the stories. And what I found is what lots of people find. The Bible is confusing, it's contradictory, it is a hot mess. There are good stories, but also terrible stories. Encountered without context, with a 13-year-old sense of history and politics and subtlety, the Bible was not much of a read. The last book is Revelation. Not, you'll grant, the simplest of tales for the uninitiated, and I put the whole thing down with a great sense of relief. What a bunch of weirdos. Well, I've revisited the Bible over the years, but it wasn't until I got to seminary, a Christian seminary, that I began to wrestle with the Bible again. I was at a very distinct disadvantage at Bright Divinity School because everyone else there, pretty much every single person there, had been reading the Bible in more depth and with more familiarity and interest than me for their whole lives. Don't ever go up against people who are raised Baptist. You will lose in all contests around Scripture. They know it. They have it memorized. They know the number, the chapter, the verse. But luckily, I'm okay at nodding along in conversations, and I'm a quick study. And I love history, and I love mythology, and I love stories. So I've been playing hardcore catch-up pretty much ever since. Since then, I've preached on biblical texts many times, trying to relate those stories to our faith. Because, guess what? Unitarian Universalism is a Bible-born faith. Our history is literally the history of struggling with this text. Our roots go back to the Alexandrian priest Arius, who antagonized everyone at the Council of Nicaea in 325, insisting that by his reading of the gospel, God was of a different essence than Christ. Arius was banished by Constantine, and when the emperor relented and invited him back home, Arius died shortly thereafter, and it seems likely that he was poisoned by his enemies. Unitarian forebear Michael Servetus wrote On the Errors of the Trinity in 1531, asserting that there's zero mention of Trinitarianism in the Bible, and making a ton of friends in the Catholic and Protestant worlds by doing so. Servetus went on the run and lived for 20 years undercover, but in 1553 he was burned at the stake on a pile of his own books while Calvin watched. Now, little pro tip, Servetus was kind of, let's just say he was a little bit of a snot, and he had decided to go hear Calvin preach at a big church in Geneva. So I don't understand why he was surprised when he was arrested afterwards. So leaders in the Holy Roman Church were so pleased at Calvin's burning of Servetus that they sent Calvin a thank you letter and then burned him in effigy themselves just for fun. In 1819, William Ellery Channing famously preached the Baltimore Sermon, in which he rejected not only the Trinity, but the common Christian insistence on the inherent sinfulness of human nature. Channing based his arguments firmly in the Bible and went overnight from largely unknown to largely infamous. So, I say all that to let you know it's okay for us UUs to struggle with the Bible. Like it or not, our faith owes more to the Bible than to Buddhism, even if I sometimes find Western Buddhist teachings more palatable than many of the biblical interpretations with which we are accosted in daily life. Which brings me to today. Many of my friends, and perhaps a few of you who've known me for years, may have heard me variously considering, arguing with, cursing, and blessing the Bible for about 5 years now. You've seen me fascinated by some stories, horrified by others. I have whined and complained the whole time because I've bemoaned my lack of experience and also sometimes just interest. But I've also learned. And one thing I've learned is that taking the Bible seriously helps me understand our culture, our faith, and myself better. And I'm telling you all of this because context is important. We often make assumptions about one another's religious beliefs and political beliefs in Unitarian Universalism, just like everywhere else, right? How many of us go out in our daily lives to the grocery store and the gas station, even our places of school and work, and pass as normal, calm Texas Christians? Here we all are gathered as Unitarian Universalists. Many, if not most of us here, have atypical views of the Bible. But even here, there are differences. So I think it's important for me to have provided this context to you as we visit the world of Lazarus and the rich man together. So let's look at that parable once more, right after I get a drink of water. The story you heard is one about reversals and opposites. The rich man lives in a gated community. The poor man is the homeless guy who sleeps on the sidewalk just outside the gates, comforted only by the dogs who hang around and keep him company. Both Lazarus and the rich man die, and the reversals begin. Now, the rich man is in Hades, which is a very Greek notion written by the thoroughly Greek author of the book of Luke. And Lazarus is hanging out with the angels and with Abraham, getting all kinds of sweet treatment. The rich man says to Abraham, "Hey, tell Lazarus to bring me some water. It's pretty dry down here." And there's something interesting about that I noticed. Even after they're both dead, the rich man is still ordering around the poor man. And he can't even be bothered to speak directly to the poor man. He's got to ask Abraham. Because Abraham surely has the authority, right? And so I like to imagine here that Abraham gives the rich man a look. You know the look? Mm-hmm. Moms, you know the look. Well, child, Abraham says, you have already had your measure of good things. It's Lazarus' turn now. And also, you can see perfectly well that there's this huge chasm between us. And it's fixed. So even if someone wanted to cross from heaven to Hades, they couldn't do it, and they don't want to anyway. The rich man laments his fate and thinks of his five brothers, still on earth and no doubt stepping over homeless people to get to their dining tables. "Hey, send Lazarus to warn my brothers," the rich man asks Abraham. And again, he doesn't speak directly to the poor man. But at this point, Abraham is pretty much over it. "Your brothers have Moses and the priest to tell them how to act," Abraham says. Lazarus protests. "I think they'd listen better to a ghost," he says. But Abraham shakes his head. If they don't listen to Moses and the prophets, they are never going to be convinced, even if somebody does rise from the dead. This is clever, too, because remember who's telling this story? It's Jesus. And he knows what's coming down the road, even if his listeners do not. Jesus talks a lot about money in the Bible. I've read that every three stories and conversations that Jesus had included talk of money, riches, poor, equity, justice, all around economic justice. And so that's a lot of money talk. And I imagine that perhaps the rich man and his brothers were the Jewish versions of megachurch goers, perhaps. In the context of the times, they were rich men, and they probably took really nice offerings to the temple on holy days, and they spent most of their time feeling pleased with themselves, because then, as now, there's a firm belief that good and bad behavior have worldly ramifications, karma, if you will. So if you're suffering, you probably did something wrong, and by contrast, if you're doing well for yourself, well, God probably likes you. Talk about your reversals, though. Jesus comes along here and says, oh, no, you have got it backwards. The minute that you use your privilege and your wealth and your riches to shield yourself from the suffering of the world, the instant that you step over the homeless man sleeping outside your gate, you've started digging that chasm. The poor aren't poor because they've offended God. They're poor because the wealthy need the poor to use up, to burn up in the forges of industry. The Industrial Revolution hadn't happened, but the engines of consumption have always burned hot and bright. It wasn't the wealthy who dug the aqueducts and made up the front lines in Roman armies. It wasn't the affluent who were pulling the weeds and trimming the olive trees in the Garden of Gethsemane. And it wasn't the comfortably well-off who picked cotton in Egypt or in Alabama. Liberation theologian Miguel de la Torre says, "The miracle of the incarnation is not that God became human, but rather that God became poor." Whether you believe that Jesus was the Son of God or not, there is no denying that he was a rebel, a man built on revolution and reversal. He was born, he lived, he died. We know this, and we know how he died. Crucifixion was slow and brutal and, above all, public. Jesus did not die in a cell because the wealthy, the powerful, the comfortably well-off needed his death to be public. The rich man's brothers needed Jesus' death to be public. And never mind about that yawning chasm over there, separating us from what we know to be right action and the actions we actually take. So how does this story speak to us, inheritors of the liberal religious tradition, but also and mostly members of the comfortably well-off class? Well, I don't believe in heaven or hell, personally. I am firmly agnostic on what happens to us after we die. I can honestly say that I find hell to be exactly as plausible as Hades. Both are interesting to think about in an academic way, and neither have any effect whatsoever on my daily life or decision-making. But that chasm is real, and it's there. It's the gulf between what we say and what we do. It's the gulf between heaven and hell on earth. No need to wait for the afterlife. The bodies and brains and souls of the poor are consumed today in the same ways they were consumed 2,000 years ago, and they are consumed by you and me and our friends and our neighbors and this whole culture. And I could spend some time telling you why that's true, but you know it and I know it. We may not have to step over the bodies of the poor when we walk into Target, but they're there. They work in the factories where the clothing is made. And they drink the water that runs sluggish yellow and brown from the taps, and they breathe the air that has been clogged by pollution from the factories where they work. Not just overseas, but here. The drinking water isn't safe in Flint, Michigan, still. And it's not safe in neighboring Detroit, or Milwaukee, or Pittsburgh, or Newark, New Jersey, or Washington, D.C. Texas leads the nation in contaminated water supply. And like our toxic waste dumps, our landfills, our crumbling infrastructure, and collapsing civil contracts, the people who are most affected by tainted water aren't the comfortably well off. They are the poor, the rural, the brown and black neighbors and citizens whom we so often overlook as our neighbors and citizens, those who we see as not quite as American as us. And it's one thing to recognize such injustices and to list them as I've done here, but it's another to stop and look at them squarely. The problem is that we are busy digging the chasm, not us alone, but we're there with our teaspoons or our shovels. And we don't know which shovelful will be the one that makes that chasm finally impassable. We don't know which death of an unarmed person of color at the hands of police will be the one that tips us over into the violence that we are so busy pretending doesn't already haunt our streets. The rich man steps over Lazarus like he is invisible. So how many black people will we need to see shot on live television before we see them? We're really busy. I am really busy. I convict myself of not seeing and not knowing. I am pretending that the great reversal of my fortune is not at hand, a breath away. I'm pretending not to see the great chasm and the fact that I am standing at its brink. I am pretending not to see the gravel falling away from my toes. And I am pretending not to know that the only way to save myself is to save everyone. Every single person and plant and animal on this planet, no matter the flag under which they live or the currency with which they are bought and sold. Our job, the true job of ministry in the world, is to begin by standing still and looking and listening and believing. Our job is to stop pretending that we don't have those shovels and teaspoons in our hands. Our job is to accept that the chasm is there and there are some things we can't take back. Some gulfs that are impassable and some places to which we can no longer return. Places like innocence and ignorance and unknowing. My job is to stand here on the edge with you and hold your hand and look into the great chasm. And then my job and yours, our job together, is to reach out to the people on the other side of us and take a deep breath and begin the hard work of building connections and acknowledging how intricately and inescapably we are all entangled. Bridging the chasm between the hell of the world that is right now, right here, and the heaven of the world that could be right here and right now. That is our job. It's time to get to work. And so let's do it together. Let's be stronger together in the way of those sticks in the story. Let's remember that Martin Luther King saw that chasm too and borrow his vision as we need it, as we move forward and begin the work of building the bridge. That's our job. And friends and strangers, here is my hand. Take it, and we will begin. Amen.